Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, a packed two-hour episode featuring live interviews with King of Kong director and producer Seth Gordon and Ed Cunningham, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and writer-director of the upcoming Sigourney Weaver drama The Girl in the Park, Mr. David Auburn. From the upcoming horror film Souls Midnight, legendary producer of The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, Gray Fredrickson, and director Harry Basil. And finally, a fantastic film composer whose credits include Material Girls, The Prince and Me, and Miss Austin Regrets, Jenny Musket. It is all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. This is Movie Geeks United. I am one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and Jerry is here with us too. Hey, man.
Hey, what's up? How's everyone doing tonight?
Jerry is manning the chat room. Anyone that wants to is listening to us right now, you can log on to our chat room and converse with other film fans. Even submit your questions through the chat room there. Jerry will be monitoring it. Or if you want to call in and ask your questions of any of tonight's guests, and we have some great guests tonight, the number to dial is 718-508-9477. A great show tonight and a great series of shows throughout the week. Let me just open by telling you what we have upcoming. On Wednesday evening at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, we're welcoming Anastas Mikos, and he is the cinematographer, one of, I think, 9 or 10 cinematographers who worked on Martin Scorsese's Shine a Light, the Rolling Stones concert film
that
just premiered
awesome
in Berlin.
Film.
Yeah, incredible. And we're also going to be welcoming someone who was up for an Oscar this year, Marcos Beltrami, the composer of 310 to Yuma. That's exciting, too. I mean,
that
it stays away from the
great
Oscars.
Film.
And the next Sunday, we're welcoming legendary screenwriter and multiple Oscar winner, Bo Goldman. He wrote the script to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Cinema Woman, and Melvin and Howard. He's one of our greats.
Yeah.
And, man, how blessed are we?
We're blessed. This is the next three shows. We're blessed, no doubt.
I know. It's a terrific windfall that's hit us. We appreciate everyone out there joining us tonight. The number to dial is 718-508-9477 if you have any questions for tonight's guest. We have a packed show, so let's get right to it. We're honored to open our show tonight with a discussion on one of the most wildly entertaining and joyous cinematic experiences we have had in years. The fact that the film is set in the world of competitive arcade gaming is just one of the surprises to be found in this hysterical, enlightening, and often moving documentary. King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, just premiered on DVD following a terrific theatrical run and after spending several months being the highlight of some of this country's most prestigious film festivals. Directed by Seth Gordon and produced by Ed Cunningham, the film tells the story of Billy Mitchell and Steve Wiebe, two strong-willed men who vie for the title of world champion in competitive Donkey Kong. During the course of the film, these two personalities speak truths that are undeniably and deeply human, including our perseverance to rise above defeat and our insatiable need to be recognized and to matter. King of Kong has so impressed audiences and industry people alike that Gordon and Cunningham have both been wooed to construct a narrative feature based on that story, while Gordon is currently hard at work on Four Christmases, a holiday comedy starring Reese Witherspoon, Vince Vaughn, and Robert Duvall. It is a great pleasure to welcome director Seth Gordon and producer Ed Cunningham to our program. Gentlemen, are you with us?
Yes, thanks for having us on.
Yeah,
thank you,
Ed, and I don't think I could have said any of that any better. That was pretty good.
Well, we're honored to have you guys on. Let me tell you, this is a movie that we have fallen in love with, and I'm sure you hear this from so many tens of thousands of people who have taken this movie to their hearts. But tell me, Ed, what was the initial spark of inspiration for this picture? Did you come on board first on this?
Well, Seth and I were working on a film we were doing before called New York Doll, and I met Steve Wiebe through a mutual friend, and it just seemed like a really interesting world, these guys who took competitive classic gaming so seriously. And when I started telling Seth about it, he had an amazing connection. Seth spent a lot of his childhood summers at Fun Spot, which is a great arcade up in New Hampshire. And we both just kind of, we didn't know if there was a story there or not, but we were both intrigued by this group of mostly guys who were playing these great old games that we loved so much and grew up playing ourselves. So when we started filming, we didn't quite know what to expect, but we very early on got to go interview Billy Mitchell, and who's obviously one of the stars in the film, and just right away we fell in love with the idea that maybe there was a story here for us to find.
So you knew of Steve, and you knew of him at the time that he was trying to beat this record. That's when you came in?
Yeah. I met Steve actually just by chance 4 days after the guy showed up to his garage unannounced to check out his machine.
Yeah.
And when I came back to telling Seth about it, we were both kind of like, wait, this is over Donkey Kong, right? And so that definitely intrigued us.
Yeah, there's like a major espionage going on in the Donkey Kong world. Seth, I know that with documentary filmmaking, you never quite know what you're going to end up with at the end of the day. But when you first embarked on this, what was it that you were looking for?
Well, there's something about the intensity with which these guys all fight for records on classic titles that I thought was sort of truly awesome and kind of truly American, to try to make a difference, to try to make history, to try to be part of history.
Yeah.
And I found all of the rivalries really interesting, and the more we uncovered, the more interesting each of them got. And when we started this whole concept, this whole idea, we weren't sure which rivalries we were going to be following in the long run. Because the Pac-Man story is great, Miss Pac-Man is great, the Dig Dug story is great. And it, as the events unfolded, since you've seen the film and not wanting to spoil it for anyone, the Donkey Kong rivalry just took over because it was fascinating what we happened to be there for during this event.
And tell me about, because I know that you had, I think you said, 350 hours of footage to comb through to make this documentary. Were there lots of strands and lots of characters, obviously, that you had to cut out? And what was the most difficult kind of parts that you had to eliminate?
I think the last story that we couldn't fit into the movie that I really wanted to fit was the Miss Pac-Man rivalry.
Yeah.
Because there's a guy in Queens named Abner Ashman who's the best in the world at Miss Pac-Man, and all of the, there's like 10 guys that can get to the end of Pac-Man or Miss Pac-Man with any predictability at all. But Abner has, in a way that he can't really articulate, figured the game out so that he gets to the end almost every time, and he's given sort of the magic set of 8 boards that allows him to maximize his score after the kill screen. So
wow.
It's just sort of this like Jedi story that I think is fascinating. We have a piece of it on the DVD. We have a bunch of extras that allowed us to include some of the stuff we had to cut out of the feature.
I think one of the great things about the Abner story, and one of the things that really intrigued us as we were trying to undo that story and figure out what was behind it, was there was a rumor that, I don't know how well you guys remember the game Miss Pac-Man, but you get different types of fruit that comes out, and those fruit have different point values. Well, the whole idea of a game with a kill screen is to maximize the points on the way to the kill screen, and there was a rumor that Abner had figured out how to control what fruit the machine put out.
Wow.
So that he got more points per board, and, you know, we were trying to dive into that, so you can see where, you know, the geeks in us really, the hair on the back of our geek necks really stood up when we heard that one.
I thought it was amazing because looking through the DVD, and it just have fantastic extras on it, hours and hours of great extras. I thought it was interesting how Steve had actually reached the kill screen much earlier, and he thought there was something faulty with the system because it just shut off. And didn't he sell his system thinking that
we had dived into this with him in interviews. It just didn't quite fit the narrative as we were trying to tell it in the documentary. But he had a Donkey Kong machine in his fraternity in college,
right.
And, you know, he was just so much better than everyone else. And then after college, he went away from it, and he got a machine back when he was kind of trying to find his way in the professional world right out of school. And that's when he started regularly reaching what he didn't know at the time was the kill screen, which
yeah.
is where the game runs out of memory. And he actually ended up getting rid of the machine because he thought it was broken. He thought, well, something's wrong with it. It doesn't let me keep playing.
That's hysterical. Seth, tell me about Billy Mitchell. I mean, this is a guy that if a screenwriter created him, you wouldn't believe he really could exist. He's quite a character.
Yeah, I mean, Billy is definitely, he took us by surprise and is really central to our choosing to focus on the Kong story because his personality is so remarkable. When we first met him, we sort of couldn't believe all of the stuff that he was saying just because it was better than a screenwriter could possibly write. I mean, he has,
right.
he's been the king of the video game world for decades, has often been in front of cameras, and his rehearsed aphorisms and sort of this sort of persona that he's created is
yeah.
is riveting. And so we felt incredibly lucky to cross paths with him because I think he really makes the story move forward at least it did for us.
Well, big time, because when you know, I think the mistake that some people might be tempted to make is that this is a documentary about video gaming, but really, it's about these two strong personalities, and we can both relate so much to aspects of both of them.
You know, I think it was great. One of the things early on, I think Seth verbalized very early on, was exactly that sentiment that
yeah.
Billy and Steve, you may not be able to make a total movie just about Billy or a total movie just about Steve, but it's the combination of those two and how different they are in so many ways that makes it most interesting. I think Seth was very savvy in seeing that very early on, that it was the putting those two, luckily it was that they were going after the same game, so that became the rivalry right in front of our eyes, basically. So it was kind of interesting to see how two people, these are not characters, they're not written that way, how
right.
different they were and how much that supported the story as it went along.
So
and how
that
different their psychologies are. They're sort of, Billy's sort of the archetype of winner, and Steve is sort of the archetype of underdog in each of their psychologies and the way they approach competition and trying to be the best at something. And that was just fascinating to watch how the two of them approached the same task, especially when they are the only two in the world that can do this very specific thing.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you're crafting this movie, what was the turning point? What was the moment in filming that you discovered, yeah, this is the film?
I would say it was at the Guinness tournament. It actually had nothing to do with Billy or Steve. It's when Ed and I were interviewing Nicole, Steve's wife, and we understood the importance of this competition to her and her perspective on the way Steve had changed through the course of this rivalry that I think understood Kong was the one to focus on. So it wasn't until very late in the game that the story solidified, and it was really Ed's ability to see Nicole's experience with total clarity that allowed us to focus on Kong.
Yeah, I see that we have a question from the chat room, and it's concerning where the story is now. And I don't want to give away the ending of your film, but the story has kind of evolved since your film came out.
Diplomatic answer to that question, which is that you know our film was a portrait of their rivalry for a certain amount of time, but we could be doing the story of the Super Bowl champions from 2005.
That's right.
Wins mm-hmm. the next year, the title goes to somebody else. So basically, the fight continues. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it really does. But is there a place online where they can find updates on the story
yeah,
as
yeah.
it's unfolding?
Oh, well, a great place to go is TwinGalaxies.com.
Speaking of Twin Galaxies, one of the other questions from the chat room was, what was Walter Day's reaction to the film?
I think that this rivalry between Billy and Steve has been the most dramatic rivalry in what was I guess a pretty up and down roller coaster career for Walter as a video game referee.
Right.
I mean, he's dealt with a lot of chaos in the last 30 years, and or I guess 25 years on this. And I think this was the most intense because of Billy and Steve and because of Roy Awesome, Mr. Awesome.
Right, right.
Plays an important role in this rivalry.
You know, I had a lot of talks. We showed Walter the film last year when we premiered it up at in Park City. And we showed the film to Walter, and he had just a very emotional, almost physical reaction to watching the film. He was kind of doubled over and just, you know, you could sense a deep level of thinking and feeling about the story. And then he didn't really want to talk about it too much afterwards. But I talked to him about a week or two later. And one of the things that I found fascinating was he hadn't realized. He started this group, Twin Galaxies, with the absolute purest of intentions. And it was to give credit to a group of people who in some ways may never get credit like they deserve for some of their talents. And it had kind of started to become this old boys club where the old timers who'd been around for a long time had started to kind of self-police and set the laws based in ways that helped them. And he felt like it started to close off. And I think the film showed him in a very condensed manner that in fact had happened, that there had become this cobble of guys who just kind of wanted to service themselves. And I think that Walter really felt conflicted and really was hurt by that because that's not what he envisions Twin Galaxies mean. And in fairness to Walter, has worked very hard since he's seen the film and all of this has happened to change that and get Twin Galaxies back to what it's about, which is giving honor and recognition to people for their feats in video games.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the same time, isn't it true that Billy Mitchell himself still hasn't seen the film, or have you heard otherwise?
To the best of our knowledge, he has not seen the film, but
wow,
has mounted an elaborate smear campaign in the press that, you know, the details of which seem to require having seen it at least once.
Yeah.
But maybe we don't know. We don't know. He says he hasn't seen it, but it's hard for us to imagine that he would avoid it.
But what did, was there a point in the actual production of it that he kind of ceased his participation? Did he disagree with the direction it was going from the beginning, or what was that like?
Go ahead, Seth.
Go ahead, Ed. You do it.
Well, we worked really hard, you know, we were chasing so many stories. You know, Seth mentioned, for those who don't know the film, that we didn't really know that we had a true human story until the Guinness Tournament. Well, to put that in context, if you've seen the film, the Guinness Tournament is the last part of the film. I mean, it is the end.
Right.
That's where everything resolves, basically, is at this Guinness Tournament. So as we were going along, we were chasing so many different stories along the way that, you know, we weren't really even sure what was going on. We knew that there were so many things that we could explore in all of these different stories. So we always, when we'd sit down people to interview, we'd ask them 1,000 different things about 1,000 different games and rivalries and everything else, so that until we really got into the edit room, we didn't even know what the film was about. And so, Billy, the last interview we had with Billy was just after the Guinness Tournament ended. We were asked not to bring up Steve Wiebe's name. We were asked not to bring up Donkey Kong, that he didn't want to talk about it. And there's, you know, that wonderful moment when Steve Sanders actually brings up, who's one of Billy's best friends, brings up Steve Wiebe and Donkey Kong. And so we didn't even have to bring it up. But that ended up being the very last interview we ever had with Billy. But before that, He had tired of the whole Donkey Kong thing and didn't want it brought up anymore.
Well, the film deals with a lot of different themes. I mean, you could say obsession or the need to be the best at something or the whole underdog notion. But what do you think out of those that the audiences are really responding to more than anything else, Seth?
Oh, it's hard for me to. I don't know which thing people are responding to most in this film. I mean, it seems like, I guess if anything, it's Steve Wiebe's struggle and the fact that he has caught so many bad breaks in life and that even in an objective environment, where it's a computer game, where
right.
the scores are objective and indisputable, he nonetheless is faced with a situation where he can't come out on top. I think that's probably what people identify with most is how he never can really catch a break.
Right. I had a friend of mine put it this way, and I thought it was pretty interesting because it's exactly that we all of us from the age of about 3 years old, when our older brother took our plate because we'd eaten our peas,
right?
So that he could get credit for eating his peas, have had that where we know we've done a good job, and all we want is some form of recognition, and
yeah.
we've all been in that position where we did a good job. And no one noticed, or even worse, the actions of someone else took away the recognition we felt we deserved. And so
yeah,
it was interesting. She brought up the peas taken off your plate when you were 3 years old.
I agree with that completely. Absolutely. But do you feel like this has been a cathartic experience for Steve in a lot of ways, this film?
I think so. I think the very fact that we were following his story gave him a reason to not give up this time.
Right.
Which is one of those sort of complicated questions. Do the documentarians influence the outcome of the people they're studying? In this case, I think we definitely did, because I don't think he wouldn't surrender. And even when we thought the story was over, not to give away the ending, he went ahead and kept on playing, kept on trying to push his score higher and higher, and gave
yeah.
our film an epilogue we never expected.
Yeah, he's got integrity, man. He really does. There are plans to make a feature film of this, a narrative film. How did that come together, Ed? How did that get going?
Well, Seth and I, a long time ago, before we even had a finished cut of the film, and I think Seth even long before that, had envisioned some type of narrative film, scripted film, coming out of this world, be it even if we never found a great story to follow, just something in this subculture, something in this world. Luckily, the story as it presented itself to us is kind of a classically structured story, and
yeah.
we knew early on that we would want to try to remake it at some point. What we didn't know was that the bigger Hollywood studios would be as interested as they were. And so when we took the documentary out to try to sell it with the idea of just trying to get distribution for the documentary, the people who represented it said, hey, I have an open mind that some of these people may want to be involved in a remake. And sure enough, almost everyone who got excited and got involved in discussions of not just purchasing the documentary, but they also said, oh, yes, and we want to have the rights to remake it. And
right.
We were very lucky to find a home with Picture House for the documentary, and then New Line and their sister companies, New Line Cinema, will do the remake, because they had a very good vision of kind of in line with what we thought it could be, something very subtle and not a broad comedy. And so
that's what I was thinking, because I was thinking as I was watching it that a studio can take a hold of this and it could be the next, not that there's anything wrong with it. They're extraordinarily talented people, but I was thinking Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, that kind of movie where they play these off the wall kind of comedic parts, but these real life characters have such heart to them. There's such a real heart to them that I think that would kind of take away. Has there been any kind of story conferences or casting ideas as to the feature film yet?
We don't think until we figure out what the script is. We aren't trying to nail down cast too specifically. Our script development process has been interrupted by the writer's strike, which everyone knows about.
Sure.
So we're just about, hopefully, to get back in gear, because negotiations have ceased as of yesterday, which means we can finally figure our script out.
That's right. And when you guys do, I would love for you guys to come back and give us an update. But before I let you go, Seth, I got to ask you about Four Christmases. This is a big film. I know that you're working hard on it right now. How did this opportunity come about to do Four Christmases?
It's real simple. Vince Vaughn saw Kong and invited me in to read the script, the This Before Christmas's script, and just felt like it was a good match. And it was really his faith in me that made it all possible. I don't think that this opportunity and this enormous chance would have happened without him. So that's pretty much it.
Well, you're living the dream. I mean, it's a Reese Witherspoon and Vince Vaughn, and this is what I got to know. When you're working with these terrific actors, you know, you're on your big feature film set. What's that first day like when you have to give Robert Duvall that first piece of direction? How intimidating is that?
He actually makes it really easy, and there's a handful of other guys that are incredibly talented that are a part of the film as well. That all are just these classically trained, incredibly talented folks, and you'd think it would be a scary situation, and I guess it could have been, but they make it so accessible and so easy that it's just about what are the ideas, what's the creative intention we have right now, and what's the best way to do that. It's been nothing but a blast, honestly, working with all of them.
Oh, I bet. Man, what a talented group.
Hey, Seth, did you know living the dream would be working 20 hours a day for 7 days?
I imagined it might be, but it turned out to be pretty intense. Thanks for having us on, guys.
Thank you both so much. Please feel free to come back on any time when you have an update about the King of Kong or when Four Christmases reaches release.
Okay, cool. Thanks
Great.
For having us.
Thank you both, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. That is Seth Gordon and Ed Cunningham, director and producer of King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, which I think we both can easily agree is one of the best documentaries we've seen in years. Best film.
Absolutely. Definitely the best of last year as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. You had a feeling that they wanted to get off the phone as quickly as possible? Was I going to ask something dangerous about that?
Yeah, I think they might have been afraid of that, yeah.
No. I'm nothing but like elated for them. What a success story.
Yeah, it is.
And it's something that you can't predict. I mean, they started on this path, and they're obviously going to be following this King of Kong story for a while. I mean, it's going to take up a good chunk of the opening act of their careers. You know?
I think so. I mean, there'll probably be another edition of the DVD, or just definitely like a follow up movie, maybe. There'll definitely be something. I mean, because it's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, wonderful, entertaining film, and just a great group of talent there. Okay, are we all set for our next guest?
Yes, we are.
How's the chat room doing?
The chat room's fine. It's been a little bit quiet, but everyone's very excited.
Yeah, everyone is very excited. It's an exciting show tonight. Our next guest, David Auburn, is here. His 2000 play Proof earned him a flurry of prestigious awards, including a Tony and the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. The supremely talented writer followed this momentous achievement by focusing on the big screen, beginning with a cinematic adaptation of Proof and the Keanu Reeves-Sandra Bullock romance The Lake House. Now he continues his meteoric rise by stepping behind the camera, writing and directing The Girl in the Park, a phenomenally involving drama starring Sigourney Weaver, Kate Bosworth, Kerry Russell, and a host of other terrific character actors. It is a great honor to welcome Mr. David Auburn to Movie Geeks United. David, are you with us?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks a lot, guys. I have to apologize. I've got a little kind of a big cold going, so I hope I can be intelligible here.
I'm with you, man. I'm stifling coughs all the way through this broadcast, so I'm right there with you. Tell me when your love of theater began. Take me back to the beginning. When did you start catching the theater bug?
Well, I'd always done a lot of theater as a kid and community theaters and school and things like that, but I'd never thought about doing it professionally until sort of pretty late in college. I went to college thinking that I wanted to do something in political science or be some kind of diplomat or work in international relations, but I got involved. This is in Chicago. I got involved with a troupe that did sort of Second City style comedy sketch writing and performing. And I found out that I really liked that and that I could do it, and I kept writing longer and longer sketches, and eventually, you know, sort of wound up with a play and realized that there was no going back.
Mm. So, but were you always when did your interest, did you look to start in film in any way, or was that just a kind of a surprise that came along after the success of Proof?
Well, I'd always been passionate about movies also, and it was sort of just luck that I got a break in the theater before I ever got any break in the movies. I mean, I was sort of trying to write screenplays around the same time. So
right.
Making a movie is something that I've always wanted to do, and I was, you know, one of the things that Proof gave me was the opportunity to do it.
I'm wondering what it's like to achieve such a claim, you know, relatively so early in your career. I mean, you'd written a series of short plays. I think you wrote a drama called Skyscraper as well. But when you win a Pulitzer and a Tony, and were you 30 years old yet when you won this?
I was 31.
31. Is that a relief for some sense of achievement, or is it? Does it raise the stakes on how to top that? Is it frightening in some sense as well?
Yeah, I mean it's both things definitely. I mean you feel this incredible excitement at having sort of arrived, and also having just the opportunity to have your work get seen and widely seen, and that's incredibly exciting and gratifying. But it is, I remember also feeling a bit scared by it and feeling like, this is too much too soon, and I'm gonna pay for this later on, and you know, all that sort of stuff. So you know, it's a mixed blessing, but it's certainly not one that I would ever complain about.
Oh no, you don't want to turn that down.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But then you're brought on to adapt Proof into a screenplay. Tell me about that process. What's the difference in discipline between playwriting and screenwriting?
Well, I think in the play is very much an expression of what the author wants to have on stage, and the whole culture of the theater is designed around making sure that everybody's sort of serving the playwright's, desires. And that is not true in the movies, obviously. It is a director's medium. So,
sure.
You know, I think that it was a very kind of difficult transition to go from a place where it was sort of my play to going to a place where it was someone else's movie, essentially. And it wasn't an entirely happy process, I have to say. I think the finished film is fine, but it certainly wasn't, it was a bumpy road, I think.
Right. But you're pleased with the finished adaptation?
Yeah, essentially I am. I mean, there are definitely things about it that I wish had been done differently, but I think, you know, as films that are made from plays go, it's a pretty good one.
Yeah. This is something that I'm very interested in, going back to the theatrical run and really involving the film as well. When you see these characters that you've nurtured and you've written and created, inhabited by such a variety of top-notch actors. I mean, thinking of the lead, it's been played by Mary Louise Parker and Jennifer Jason Leigh, and I think Anne Heche and Gwyneth Paltrow for the film. Did each of them bring something new to the role that you were surprised by?
Sure. I mean, there was every time a new cast came in, there was a whole new dynamic. And one of the things that really made me proudest of the play was that the play sort of ended up being flexible enough that it could accommodate these different approaches to it. But, you know, Mary Louise created the role, and in some way it's always sort of her, going to be her role. It's a very indelible
right.
impression she made in it. But it did change, you know, quite radically from performer to performer, and it was very exciting to see what people brought to it. I mean, probably the biggest surprise was Anne Heche, who's one of my favorite people to have done it. She, having not known her, but only knowing that she was a good actor, finding out that she had this incredible theatrical power. I mean, she's this tiny person, but we put her on a Broadway stage and she completely dominated the auditorium. And
oh, yeah.
Also for such a glamorous and attractive woman, managed to get deep into the soul of this weird little nerd that she was playing in such a in such a deep way that it was really startling. I mean, I remember the first time I saw her do it in front of an audience and being blown away by it.
Yeah, I can imagine. And we're going to talk about Sigourney Weaver in a little bit as well, because she's giving life to you, the lead character in your new work. But I would think that would have to be one of the highlights of what you do, seeing these tremendously talented people give life to your characters.
I mean, I think that's the reason to be in the performing arts as opposed to doing something else. I mean, if you weren't interested in what other people could bring to your work and watching them fill up the sort of glass that you've made, you'd be a novelist or a poet or something else. But what, you know, the alchemy that occurs when you write a role and you sort of have left those spaces for the personality or the insight or the inspiration of the person who's going to come in and play it, and the magic that happens when those two things come together and create something that's larger than what you originally imagined, that to me is the point of, you know, writing for the theater, for the movies. It's that excitement that's really unique to those things.
Oh yeah, it's got to be. So when you were with the success of Proof, were you brought on to write The Lake House, or was that a script that you already had written that you had tucked away somewhere? What was the story behind that?
Well, no, they came to me. They had this Korean film called Il Mare that had that basically had the premise of The Lake House, that there was this house and people who could communicate in time, even though they were separated by a number of years, and they had a romance. And I was hired to do an American adaptation of it. And I liked the premise, and I thought it was an interesting sort of non-science fiction, science fiction movie. I did the adaptation for Warner Brothers. And in the end, I was sort of one of many hands in that particular stew, and other people were brought in to do work. But I was pleased with the way the finished film came out.
That's got to be kind of disappointing in a way. I mean, coming from theater where, you know, the writer is king, and film is such a different medium, and you're right, there's so many hands in the stew. How do you deal with that? Do you have to detach yourself somehow from that?
I mean, on a movie like The Lake House, when you get a big studio job, I think you go into it with your eyes wide open, and you know that you're not in the position that you're in the theater or in when you're directing your own movie. I mean, I think, you know, if it goes well, you're in the position of being like a contractor on a construction site, and, you know, it's your job to put on the roof, and they need a good roof, and they need it not to leak, and they're going to pay you nicely to get it on there, and they respect you for doing it well, but it's not your house, you know. So I think if you go in with realistic expectations, that kind of work can be quite enjoyable. But
yeah,
it's not obviously as satisfying as building the house yourself. And so, you know, a few experiences like that very quickly lead you to the conclusion that if you want to have the kind of control over the material in the movies that you have in the theater as a playwright, you better direct your own movie.
And here you are. Here we are with The Girl in the Park. So tell me the origins of this. What first inspired the idea? Tell us a little bit about the plot of the film.
Well, the story is pretty simple. It's basically that a woman has lost her daughter. Her daughter disappears one day when they're playing in Central Park. And the bulk of the movie takes place 15 years later, when this woman's life has sort of never recovered. She shut down afterward, and her marriage fell apart, and she has sort of entered this kind of half-life where she is pretty closed off to the world. And then she meets a young woman who is the same age that her daughter would have been if she'd never disappeared. And they begin this sort of series of tense encounters. The young woman is not very trustworthy. She's a bit of a con artist. She's sort of living from hand to mouth. But she has this appeal for the mother, played by Sigourney Weaver. And over the course of the movie, they develop a relationship where Sigourney's treating the young woman, who's played by Kate Bosworth, like her daughter, and Kate lets her do that, even though they both know that this is a fiction that they've created. And they grow closer and closer to one another, while at the same time the tension of sort of maintaining this charade grows, especially because Sigourney has a son, a grown son, who's been trying to get close to her for years and who feels very threatened by this relationship. So it all sort of builds to a head, and it's, you know, it's a drama about this mother and this daughter, but it's also, there's also a lot of humor in it and about family life, and it's a complicated little story.
It's an independent production, I take it.
Right.
Was it an arduous process getting it off the ground?
It was. I mean, we actually got it made fairly quickly. I think I was shooting about 18 months after I finished the script.
Okay.
But getting from a script with producers attached to starting shooting on the first day in New York City was there were a lot of ups and downs. There were a lot of mornings where you get a phone call in the morning saying it's all off because we lost X this person and we're wrapping the production. And then at 5 o'clock that afternoon, someone says, "Oh no, wait, we found a way to keep it going," or whatever. So I was never really sure until the first day on the set that we were going to get the movie made.
Yeah, because I remember reading about this this project maybe a year and a half or so ago, and it had kind of different cast members attached. But you're talking where you are now. I mean, you have Sigourney Weaver and Kate Bosworth and just amazing actors. Tell me how a Sigourney Weaver, what it's like to work with her in this kind of role. What does she bring to it?
She was the person that I had in mind from the very beginning, and I really love I love her intelligence, and
yeah.
I knew that one of the things that I wanted to have happening in this movie was that we make no mistake that this woman who's doing this crazy thing of pretending that this stranger is her daughter was deluded or crazy or rolling off the rails. I mean, that wasn't the point that I wanted to make at all. I wanted us to really see that this was a very intelligent, calculating person who was making this choice for herself just because it felt so good and was so satisfying for her to have this girl in her life again. But while she also sort of knew all the risks she was running, and I knew that with Sigourney, we would see those kind of calculations going on behind her eyes all the time, and I could really imagine that working with her, and that's pretty much what did happen. I mean, she is so well prepared and has thought through so carefully all of the nuances of the scene. Very often she was ahead of me. I mean, it was a very unusual day when I could give her a note that she hadn't already sort of thought of and worked through.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a dream. That's a dream collaborator there.
She was great. I mean, I really could not, in addition to the fact that we were shooting on an extremely short schedule so that we had to have actors who were willing to really kind of do a ridiculous amount of work in an incredibly short time, I couldn't give them a lot of takes. I couldn't let them have a lot of the time that I would have liked to give them, on another kind of movie. So I was just lucky that people like Sigourney were completely sort of roll up your sleeves, get it done. Maybe it wasn't perfect, but let's move on kind of performers.
When you write characters, do you picture particular actors, or does that tend to be a trap?
Now, sometimes you find yourself picturing people without really meaning to, but mostly when I'm writing, I'm just thinking about what the characters is trying to do and what they want moment to moment, and trying to let them get what they want and fight to get what they want.
Yeah. Did anything about directing surprise you? How did you take to it?
I really liked it. I mean, I directed a lot in the theater before, so I had some familiarity with working with actors.
Right.
I think the thing that probably surprised me the most was realizing how much of directing happens before the camera starts rolling. I remember the feeling getting to the set on the first day and having spent months thinking, well, this will be my first day of directing, and then realizing, well, we have this location, it's been dressed the way we've planned, here are the actors that we've cast, the script is written, I've worked out the shots with the DP. There are small choices to be made now about like where to push people and when to move on to the next setup, but most of the main decisions that were going to determine what the film was going to turn out to be like had been made by me, over the last several months. So
sure.
that was a real revelation to me. And just especially I think on a film like this where we only had 26 days, probably 80% of the work is figuring out how to manage your time and making minute by minute decisions about, is this time better spent on another take here, or should we move on to the next setup, or those kind of choices dominate your working day more than far more than any sort of creative or artistic thoughts. I mean, I guess those are ultimately creative and artistic choices, but they didn't feel like it very much at the time.
Yeah, but to 26 days, that's a harrowing kind of pace to have to shoot a whole movie.
It was horrible. I mean, it was great. We had a great time, but you know, it was just rough waking up every morning thinking, you know, if it rains today, we're completely screwed. You know, that kind of thing, that we had no margin for error. But luckily, we did get through it, and everything went really well.
Yeah. But in terms of style and the film style and the pacing, were there other films that you looked at for inspiration?
I really liked some of the early Jonathan Demme movies, like Melvin and Howard.
Yeah.
And the feeling that you get of like a real messy lived-in American life. Nothing too stylized, nothing too cold, because I felt that, you know, I already had a story that had a lot of emotional distress and loneliness in it. I didn't want to come out the other end of the process with something that was extremely stark or alienating.
Right. It's funny that you mention Melvin and Howard, because we're welcoming Bull Goldman to the show next week, and he's another one of our favorite writers. So that's interesting. Are you looking to continue your work in theater? Are you wanting a career both in film and theater simultaneously?
If I could do both, I'd be a very happy man. I mean, I'm working on a new play, and I'm working on some movie stuff as well. So, you know, the greater variety of things I can keep my hand in, the better.
Yeah. I know that The Girl in the Park premiered at Toronto.
Right.
When can we expect a theatrical release on that?
Later this year. It was bought by the Weinstein Company at Toronto, so I'm not sure how the release is going to be handled yet, but I hope that, you know, sort of by the end of 2008 you'll be seeing it.
Okay, sounds terrific. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us tonight, and we'll look forward to The Girl in the Park. And you say that you're working on a play right now. Is there anything else upcoming for you on the film horizon?
No, right now, but now that it looks like the strike is winding up, I hope.
You never know. You never know.
Yeah,
it could be.
Well, please come back and join us when you're feeling a little bit better, and when you have and when The Girl in the Park reaches theatrical release, we'd love to speak to you again.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Bye bye.
That is David Auburn, a phenomenally talented writer, and now he's behind the camera directing The Girl in the Park, his directorial debut in a feature film.
It's amazing.
It's quite a pedigreed film, too.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, very much so. So we have a little breather here before our next couple of guests. Have you seen anything lately? Do you have any films that have inspired you as of late, Jerry?
Well, the only film that's inspired me, really, and I think you know what it is the
Rambo,
Thomas
right?
Anderson film. That's the only thing that's inspired me. And I was meaning to go see it again this weekend, but something came up. But
right. That's
the only thing I'm interested in. I won't lie to you.
Well, you know, it's one of those fascinating movies you can't get out of your head.
And
there is a great need to see it again and make sense of that experience.
I've made sense of it. I just want to go see it again because there's just so many parts of the film I adore.
Yeah.
I really do. I have, you can almost say the day after I saw it, which I guess was the end of the year, I just fell in love with it. But that's right now the only film really on my mind. There's stuff I want to see, obviously, coming out that we talked about on Wednesday's show, like Jumper and Be Kind, Rewind, and those things I want to see. But I can't get the Paul Thomas Anderson film out of my head. I won't lie
to you. Yeah, it's really going to be very interesting to see this Oscar telecast, which apparently the Oscar telecast,
it's going to happen.
Writers,
it's happening, and it was going to happen regardless. But they, you know, they said, like a guy that I read an interview, and I think it was the Times the other day, said this is happening. They want to get this resolved because they have the Academy Awards. No one wants to see the Academy Awards end up like the Golden Globes this year. And I think that was, I know that was definitely a catalyst for it, but it does sound like, at least from the Writers Guild East, that this is a good deal.
And that's what you've heard?
Yeah, that this is a good deal. That's from the East. I don't know anything yet from the West Coast, but I know from articles I read today from the East, this is a good deal.
Okay, we have some...
Looks like our show went dead. According to Elise Anthony, the audio went dead.
Well, it's We're still able to speak.
Yeah, we're still able to speak, but I don't know if...
I can hear you. I mean, in the past when our lines have gone dead, you wouldn't be able to hear me, Jerry.
Right, yeah, so...
Let me see here.
You want to play it on your player there, or do you want me to play it on mine to see if...
No, hang on. If you want to try to bring it up on yours, and I'll be talking here. Let me see if anybody out there in the room can hear us. I'll try to keep the conversation going. In about 10 minutes, we're going to... Eric G hears nothing. Okay.
Okay, you know what? I'm not getting anything either.
All right, let me call back in. Let me call back into the show. Hang on.
Okay, all right.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can anyone hear anything out there?
Anyone out on the chat room?
Let me...
back on. Okay, we are back on. Eric is making a sarcastic comment.
Yeah, thank you, Eric, for that sarcastic remark.
If anyone can hear us out in the chat room now, after rebooting the screen, please let us know. Yes, now we can hear. Okay, awesome. Don't want you to miss a single second of what we have to say.
Yeah.
It's gravity of every word that we utter.
Yeah, exactly.
It's important stuff. In about 8 minutes, we're going to be welcoming director Harry Basil and producer Gray Fredrickson. They have a new film called Souls Midnight, which I was just able to see last night, actually.
Cool.
And it's very good, and it's Armando Sante. I'm a sucker for anything with Armando Sante.
No, he's great. He was good in American Gangster, and I like, you know, whenever he pops up, I love to see him, so.
Oh, yeah, he's got such a presence about him, man.
Mm-hmm.
You remember, was it like the first time he really came to our attention were movies like The Mambo Kings and Q&A? And,
mm-hmm. He was great in Q&A. He was
wasn't
superb.
He in Q&A? Yeah, he was, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was superb in that.
Yeah, and that's one of those Sidney Lumet movies we kind of... No, not us, but it's sadly kind of looked over
mm-hmm.
in the mainstream, you know.
Oh, big time.
Yeah. So we're going to... And Gray Fredrickson, by the way, is the producer of the Godfather trilogy, of Apocalypse Now,
and
The Outsiders, just a series of landmark movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so talk about getting our geek on. I mean, we're about to get our Godfather geek on.
Get the whole entire Coppola restoration geek here going.
That's right. So if anyone has any questions for our guest, the number to call is 718-508-9477. If anyone on the chat room can give us some sense of when our audio went out, if it was during the interview or after the interview that we just finished up concluded, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, that would be.
And for those of you listening in archive, we just came back from a blackout. I'm sure a lot of you guys know out there what that's like.
Yes.
So there will be blood.
Yeah, I just can't get it out of my head. I listen to the soundtrack a lot. I read up on it a lot. I just been meaning to go see it again. Just time hasn't been on my side, but... That's one of the best. I mean, it's just one of the best things I've seen, and we've talked about it before. And I just see Anthony just said that he it went out after the interview.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Anthony, and thank you, Eric.
At least the important people got their full time in. That's great.
Yeah.
So, do you have a different? Are your feelings about the outcome of the Oscars changing at all?
I think it's going to be what we've been seeing. I think it is going. You know, I think it's going to be No Country for Old Men. I think it's going to be that's going to get Best Picture. And I think that's probably going to get Best Director because of the Directors Guild and the writers, you know, all the awards that have been going.
Yeah.
I just think it's going to follow. It will be upsets if it doesn't follow that.
Right.
But I think it is going to follow a formula this year of what's happened the whole award season.
It's got the momentum.
Yeah.
At the same time, I like to, and this is why I'm so happy I got DVR now, I like to record the Oscars. And I actually like to rewatch them years later, but right off the bat, I like to rewatch them when they announce the winner.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the five screens. You know, they have the cameras focused on each one of the nominees.
So you can see Bill Murray upset.
If I can see if that's genuine happiness for the other nominee that picks up the award.
Right. No, I got you.
Yeah, it's just one of those sick little things I do. But also, there's also the comedy aspect of it. I remember one year, I think it was Sam Jackson, started cursing or started mouthing like he was cursing when they announced the winner and it wasn't him. And he said, I just did that for fun. That was just a...
Oh, sure.
No. I'm sure he did, because he knew the cameras right. And he was very animated when he did it. It's got to be really...
Nerve-wracking.
Yes. Have the camera right in your face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and beads of sweat, like, pouring down your brow. And it's got to be terrifying. What do you think of Jon Stewart? You know, the one thing that we haven't talked about is the host.
Mm-hmm.
And where you rank Jon Stewart?
I think he's too good for them because, you know, you can't forget the, you know, after, you know, the George Clooney when he won for Syriana, he took it so seriously, like the, and Jon Stewart was joking. You know, we know Jon Stewart's style. And it was like his acceptance speech, Clooney's, was like he was defending, like, the whole, the Hollywood establishment. It was like, George, chill out. He's just joking. He's laughing with you, not at you. You know, and
oh, as a response to Stewart's comedy.
Yeah, and I was like, that took me. And you know, South Park made fun of it in the whole episode. His speech, Clooney's speech, that is. But I think Jon Stewart's a good. I think he's a good host. I think. Look, it's a hard gig to do.
It's impossible.
I thought Ellen was good, and I thought John was good. I even thought Chris Rock was good. Granted, he got carried away with it. I don't know what Jude Law ever did to him. But I know it's
there's the sensitivity, though. I mean, if you – there are many different types of comedians, and part of me was very excited about seeing Chris Rock host the awards.
Right, right.
To see somebody, like, really shake it up. But you can't be –
They don't like it for some reason.
You can't be sensitive to that kind of thing. I mean, that's a comedian's life is a satire and satirizing,
yeah.
and he's playing to the audience. He's satirizing.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't know why they were so surprised by that, because you know what you're getting.
Yeah.
When you,
yeah.
It's like when Stephen Colbert did the White House press corps dinner a couple of years ago. I rewatched
that last week, actually.
Yeah. You know
that's
what
comedy
you're getting.
Gold.
You know what you're getting when you do that. You shouldn't be. I would like to see Chris Rock come back. I'd like to see Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg come back, for that matter. I think they've all done good jobs. It's just a very hard gig. I don't care who you are.
I think with Robin Williams, I think they're maybe possibly afraid that the telecast will go over 6 hours. Don't you think that's the fear out there? That
yeah.
Obviously a brilliant man, but you get him going. I mean, we're talking. You think the Oscars are long already?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you know who I did like, even though I mean because he made fun of it that he bombed, and he made fun of it for years to come. David Letterman.
You actually did like that.
I didn't like it, but I liked the fact because of his humor. He made fun of it. He always brought up his Oscar, you know, his Oscar failure, as it was. So I like that he was able to make fun of it, because it was pretty bad.
That's the core of his comedy, though. The core of his comedy is self-deprecation.
Yeah.
That's why we love Dave.
Yes, exactly.
And so for him to kind of laugh it off, and you know, it's almost like what George Clooney does with his contribution to the Batman franchise.
Exactly. Very good analogy.
It feels, people love that. People love that quality in people,
mm-hmm.
so. I see that one of our next guests is on the line. The number's changed a couple of times, so I'm going to give it another minute to see if when both of them come on the line at the same time.
Okay.
But thanks, everyone out there, for joining us in the chat room tonight. If you have a question for any of tonight's remaining guests, the number to call is 718-508-9477. We've spoken to the King of Kong filmmakers Seth Gordon and Ed Cunningham. That movie is now available on DVD. It's a terrific documentary. And we've also spoken to Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, screenwriter, director David Auburn. He wrote Proof for the stage and for film. and his new project he's behind the director's chair on, and it's called The Girl in the Park. And look for that later this year. It stars Sigourney Weaver. We were talking about a great number of prestige projects tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And just to remind everyone, Wednesday night, we're going to welcome Anastas Mikos. He is the DP, the cinematographer, on Scorsese's new concert film, Shine a Light. He's also the cinematographer of the new version of The Women. That'll be out soon, I believe. And we'll get the scoop on that. And we'll also be speaking to Marcos Beltrami, the Oscar-nominated composer this year of 310 to Yuma, just days away from the Oscars. I can't wait to get his sense of how he's feeling. You know, that's got to be nerve-wracking.
It is. I would imagine it's very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, but thrilling at the same time. I mean, part of you just wants to cherish it, and part of you wants to just get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure. And the next Sunday night, we'll be welcoming Oscar-winning screenwriting legend Bo Goldman, the writer behind One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, Sin of a Woman, Melvin and Howard, which David Auburn mentioned in his interview.
Yes, he did.
Very influential talent, and we can't wait to welcome him on the show. Okay, let's get started. Let's get started with our next guest, okay?
Oh, sounds good.
Okay, Soul's Midnight is a new horror film starring Armand Asante that tells the story of a vampire cult requiring an infant sacrifice in order to resurrect their ancient leader. This frighteningly effective horror film delivers a generous share of genuine scares while still maintaining the sense of delirious fun inherent in this genre. We're pleased to be joined today by the picture's director, Harry Basil, a multi-talented actor and filmmaker whose previous credits include performances in Peggy Sue Got Married and The Seventh Sign, as well as producer and screenwriting duties on Rodney Dangerfield's Meet Wally Sparks and last year's Chevy Chase comedy Funny Money. Soul's Midnight is Mr. Basil's first foray into the horror genre, having previously directed Back by Midnight, The Fourth Tenor, Funky Monkey, and Cloud Nine. Gray Fredrickson also joins us today. He is the executive producer on Soul's Midnight, and this is just the latest in a long line of his tremendous accomplishments in the industry, several of which have made him an indelible part of cinematic history. You might have heard of some of these credits. He was a production manager on classic films like The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, and Candy, before starting a legendary collaboration with Francis Ford Coppola, a relationship that saw him working as associate producer on The Godfather, co-producer on Godfather 2 and 3 and Apocalypse Now, and producer on The Outsiders and One from the Heart. It is a tremendous honor to welcome director Harry Basil and Oscar-winning producer Gray Fredrickson to Movie Geeks United. Let me bring them up here. Gentlemen, are you both with us?
Well, I don't know. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Is
this
Harry?
Yeah, this is Harry Basil. I was listening to the show. I didn't know if I was just on hold because nobody ever picked up and said hang on or anything like that.
I'm sorry.
Amazing.
Yeah, the show does play as soon as you connect. The show is on air. I apologize for that. Do we have Mr. Fredrickson with us as well?
You got me too. Same thing as Harry.
Great.
Yeah, Gray's calling from Oklahoma, and they're a little slower there.
we'll forgive that. It's a great honor to have you both on with us tonight.
Well, thank you.
And I saw your film yesterday, and I loved it. But Harry, I understand that movies have kind of always been in your blood from a very early age. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been. I'm actually a stand-up also, and my whole stand-up act is spoofing films. But I've been making movies since I was like 12 years old, and one of my first films was a vampire movie called Count Meshuggah. And it was a lot of I grew up in New Jersey. I'm Greek, but I had a lot of Jewish friends, and so we did a black and white vampire film about a Jewish vampire, and instead of a cross, you know, the Van Helsing character held up a Star of David and stuff like that.
Right, right.
And then threw Manischewitz wine on him instead of holy water. It was.
Oh, that would do it every time.
Regardless. Yeah, yeah. But I had been making movies since I was a little kid, and it, which is wild, is my favorite film of all time has always been The Godfather. And to get to work with Gray, the very first thing I ever worked on it with him was Ladybugs, right? The Rodney Dangerfield.
Ladybugs.
Yeah. And Al Ruddy, producer of The Godfather. And,
right.
Absolutely.
And made a few movies with Gray, and then this project came along. Gray knew I loved vampire movies, and he says, "Hey, we got this great script."
And in a way, looking over your bio, I mean, you mentioned Gray and you mentioned Al. Obviously, your collaboration with Francis Ford Coppola must have meant a lot to you with Peggy Sue and as well as Rodney Dangerfield.
That was pretty cool because that was the first film I acted in, and here I was a stand-up. And most stand-ups, you know, first movie is like Boob Party 2 or something like that.
Right.
So to get to work on this film, you know, with Francis and all these great actors that were in it, it wound up becoming huge superstars. I mean, Jim Carrey, Helen Hunt, Joan Allen, Nick Cage. You know, it was pretty exciting, you know, going up
wow.
to Napa. And we actually shot close to Francis's house and got to hang out at his house a lot. And he has the boat from Apocalypse Now. Did you know, Gray, that he has the what is it called?
The PBR.
What was the PBR, baby. Yeah, he's got that on his property up there. It's pretty cool. He's got some home.
Oh, wow.
I have some great home movies, Super 8 home movies from that movie, you know.
Harry does
bet.
A wonderful stand up of he parodies all kinds of movies. And it's terrific. And he was the opening act for Rodney Dangerfield for forever. How long, Harry?
Like 17 years. That's
wow.
how I got into the business is Rodney saw that I liked film so much in my act and asked me to write something with him. And the first thing we wrote was The Fourth Tenor, and then eventually we worked on Ladybugs, and that's how I met Gray. And I think we've done like four or five movies together now,
yeah,
haven't we?
Yeah, we've had some fun.
And the two
amazing.
That we're most proud of are Souls Midnight, which comes out on DVD Tuesday, February 12th, with Armando Sante, international star Armando Sante.
That's right.
And it's,
right.
It's the first time Armando's ever played a vampire, and he's really cool in the movie.
And you know, that's something that struck me, too, watching it, because he has such an, it's automatic with him, just an air of mystery about him. And I can't believe this is the first time he's played a vampire, a character like this.
Well, do you know that he told me while we were making this film that Anne Rice actually met him once, and when she wrote the book, Interview with a Vampire, there's a character named Armand, and she named him and pictured him as Armando Sante.
Oh, yeah.
But by the time they wound up making the film, you know, Armand was a little too old to play the character. But, you know, he had recalled that. He remembered that when we were doing our film. We wanted Armand. Well, the screenplay is written by Brian Cleveland and Jason Cleveland, two very talented writers, producers from Texas. And they wanted to bring it back to sort of like, and not like a Hammer vampire movie, but just a gothic, romantic vampire story. You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We were a small budget. We were under $1 million, and I'm pretty proud to say that you saw the film and you see the production value. We did it in like 13 days. But
oh,
it's so
amazing.
You get so much production value in Oklahoma. I know it sounds weird, but that gothic hotel and our locations and all, I was just blown away. You know,
sure.
We got a lot of bang for a buck.
While we're on the subject of Armando Sante, and then I want to know how this project developed, what is he like? Because we don't really get a... Like I say, he just seems so mysterious in some of these parts that he plays, and he's... So obviously, has an intense charisma on screen. But what is the actual process of working with him like?
Well, this is the second film I've done with Armand, and Gray's second film that he did with him as a producer. And I worked on him with a comedy in Romania, and he takes everything extremely serious, and he likes to have fun, but he's a very serious actor. And I've worked with a lot of actors where you walk on the set, you know, and they want to know what time they're going home or do you really need booth for the scene. Armand is
right.
not that type of an actor. As a matter of fact, there's kind of a joke. He has a nickname called One More.
Yeah.
He loves to do another take. And
oh, wow.
Like, man, Armand, you were great. Oh, come on, one more. And he gets himself really revved up. Are you allowed to curse? Are we on air?
Yeah.
You can say whatever you want.
Armand will get, like, this is what he would do. He'd pace around and he'd go, huh, fuck! Fuck! come on, roll. And he gets himself all psyched up. And the other actor, like, we had this local actor who thought he did something wrong. You know what I mean? Because he's going, because Armando's screaming, how dare you? How dare you? And here he is in this robe as this gothic vampire Simon. And this poor local actor is just, like, terrified, thinking he did something wrong, not really... realizing that that's his warm-up, you know? And it would just be really funny to see Armand doing that on, like, a Disney movie or something like that, you know, with
right.
little kids, and he's walking around going, fuck, you know?
That's great. You got a little Pacino in there with your Armando Sante as well.
Yeah,
that's very good.
I was going to say, definitely.
That's very good. So who came on board first? Did the script come to you first, Harry, or did it come to you, Mr. Fredrickson?
It came to me, and then I took it to Harry because I just I had a great experience with Harry on a picture we did called Cloud Nine with
right.
Reynolds, and I thought, and Harry, I knew always wanted to do a horror movie or a vampire, so I thought that would be great. So I hooked him up with the Clevelands, and they all hit it off, and we decided to go forward with the project.
Yeah, what happened was there was actually another script we had about Elizabeth Bathory. You know, she was that countess, Hungarian countess.
That's right.
Who
yeah.
bathed in the blood of virgin girls, killed 650 girls. And it was a pretty cool script. It wasn't as scary as Soul's Midnight. It was more action-driven, and it would have had to have been shot in Romania. But it was going to be too hard to get that script made. And Gray said to me, hey, I've got this great script written by these writers, Brian and Jason Cleveland. And I read it and loved it and had a few ideas, but said, I want to meet these guys in person. So Gray flew me to Oklahoma, coach, by the way, Frontier Airline. It was only like $250.
I think that was a slight.
And he
put
a lot of budget in. Look at I'm plugging all these places. Hampton Inn, $60 a night for a room, but a nice room. Because there's a Hooters right next door, which is always fun.
That's always good.
So I met with Brian and Jason, and these guys are like, they're super bright guys, but they're huge horror fans. And I think Jason was even wearing a Shining T-shirt, you know, The Shining. And we just hit it off right away. We love genre movies. And I mean, I talk with these guys like every day since we've been, you know, we talk about movies. What came?
Well, they
out
know
that
more
week.
About horror movies than
yeah. And what I love about their stories, this movie as well as Fingerprints, which is another film we have coming out on DVD March 25th, which I'd love to talk about after Soul's Midnight. They always like to put some gothic lore or the legend of
St. George
and the dragon is in mythology, and the way that they incorporated it into this story and Fingerprints, the urban legend about the San Antonio haunted train tracks, the children getting killed on the school bus, and even now they're doing a script on Madame Lalaurie, which is this pretty cool story. It takes place in New Orleans about a woman sort of like an Elizabeth Bathory who tortured her slaves. It's just so
wow.
cool that they always incorporate something like that into their scripts, and I really love that.
Now, is this
a
brother?
Is this
a brother team of?
Yeah. Brian is the older brother, and Jason's the younger brother, and they produced and wrote Soul's Midnight, and they also produced and wrote Fingerprints. You know, and they're pretty enterprising guys. You know, and very creative.
An endless well of creativity, it sounds like.
Yeah. Mr. Fredrickson, when you produce, are you do you tend to be a constant presence on the set, or do you kind of keep your distance?
When it's lunchtime, he is.
That's a craft service table, I'm big.
He's like, oh, they got chicken fried steak today? That's great. You know?
No, it goes back to my early days of being production manager and a line producer. I am on the set every day, and I'm there most of the day, most of the 12 to 14 hours. The last night of filming on Soul's Midnight, even after I'd had a concussion, I stayed on the set, right?
Oh,
Harry?
Yeah, forgot about that. We,
wow.
We lost our lights, the big ending, the ending of our film, we lost our lights. The generator went down, and it was like a weekend, and it's not like L.A. where you could just get a generator back down to the set right away. So we had to shoot a lot of things in close-ups, and it was really windy, and Gray was leaning back on his chair, director's chair, and he fell and whacked his head. And, you know, he got up right away, and everyone, you know, kind of laughed when they saw that he was okay. But then he asked where Francis was and if we were shooting.
I thought I was a massive.
He goes, where's Marlon? Are we shooting the ending yet? And
oh, my God.
He thought he was back in Apocalypse Now.
I didn't know where I was.
Back in the war, yeah.
Thank God he was okay. Thank God he was okay, and he could sign the checks. But we wound up shooting the ending of the film, the rest of it, in my front yard in Encino. We had Armand, the whole cast, our monster, and effects guy, Vincent Gustini, and torches and smoke machines, and we shot the ending in my front yard.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild.
Tell me about working with all of these effects. You know, obviously you have some pyrotechnics in this. You have the blood effects and the dragon that comes out of the end of it. What is that like? Is that a daunting process?
You know, especially when you're working on a low budget. You know, Vincent Gostini, who did our creature and some of our gore effects, he's a pretty big guy in the genre films. He did Snoop Dogg's Hood of Horror. He did Dogma. He created the wings, you know. And the giant shit monster that they had that came out of the toilet.
Oh, the Golgothan, okay.
Yeah. And also, I think he did Last of the Mohegans. He did all the wounds on that. Vincent's a great guy, and he's originally from Jersey. And I looked him up on the internet and spoke to him. He actually answered the phone himself, and I sent him the script, and he flipped over the script, and he had never done a vampire movie and wanted to. And I like horror films that have practical effects. I think CGI is necessary in some films, but some are so over-the-top CGI.
Oh, yeah.
Like Underworld and Van Helsing, and even Will Smith's new movie, I Am Legend, which I liked the first half, but as soon as you saw the infected creatures...
Yeah, I agree with you there.
It's so obvious that it's, you know... I love a movie like 28 Days Later, just when actors are playing the monster.
Right.
It's just so freaking scary, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, still the shark in Jaws is scary. Vincent, you know, he created this creature, this monster that just looks really cool at the end of the movie. And if we didn't have our generator problem, I really wanted to try to get it to fly. But, you know, it would have been another day of shooting in Oklahoma and a little bit more money.
I know. It looks fantastic as it is.
Yeah. I was always hoping there'd be a sequel so we could utilize it more, you know.
Well, you never know.
It only comes out at the end of the movie.
But the horror genre seems like a particularly fun one to work in. But
you know, it's so funny. I always have to buy new shoes after I'm done with these movies because they're covered in blood. I mean, we just had buckets and buckets of blood and on the fingerprints too, you know.
But like comedy, I would think, because if you're shooting a comedy, you hear the same punchline over and over again, and eventually I would think it would lose its effect on the crew.
That's if it's a Dane Cook movie.
Oh, man.
No.
I like this guy.
He's
I like this guy.
Too, Harry.
No, I'm just talking about Good Luck Chuck, you know. That was
exactly. But can you tell if it's working on a horror film set?
Well, you know something, I'm new to it, so I can't like talk like I'm, you know, this Wes Craven or something like that, but I guess the fun thing about I mean, comedy, the bullseye is so small, you know. It's very rare that a film works, you know, in comedy, that you have a Wedding Crashers or a 40-year-old Virgin. There's a lot of movies that just tank and go straight to video, but a horror film, you have more of a shot with the budget that we were doing, of maybe having something, you know, decent. I mean, look at the success of Blair Witch and Cabin Fever.
Yeah.
Saw, which the first one I think cost a little over $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you have, but with comedy, it's very rare that you'll have a Napoleon Dynamite or something that was made for $500,000 that can just hit it out of the ballpark and everybody, you know.
That's true, and we talk about this a lot on the show, how lower budgets, the lower budgeted horror films tend to feel so much more frightening than the higher budget. There's something primal about, and maybe it's the momentum of having to shoot on such a limited budget and the time constraints. Maybe that kind of furious momentum plays into the feel of the film. But you're absolutely right. The independent horror films work extremely well.
Well, also you get a chance to experiment with filmmaking, you know, and try different techniques and lighting techniques and camera angles and try to, you know, I mean, basically you're trying to reinvent the wheel with a new killing sequence, you know what I mean? I was reading, we have a great 5-page article on our both of our films in this month's issue of Fangoria. And they did a really nice spread on Souls Midnight, if you guys want to check that out, anybody wants to check that out, and Fingerprints. But I was reading about Dario Argento, his new film, and just how he's basically shot everything. And the biggest challenge for him is the killings in each new movie and how he's going to shoot it and what's going to be unique about it, you know, something that you remember about it. Like even in this year's critically acclaimed and Oscar-nominated No Country for Old Men, the one thing that really stuck out to me was that first murder where Javier Bardem is strangling that poor deputy.
Right, right.
And the scuff marks on the ground.
That was a wild scene, yeah.
You know, and they didn't plan that. I went to the Directors Guild and saw the Coen brothers talking about this, that the scuffs happened by accident. And they looked at it and go, wow, that's really cool looking. So they kept trying to do the shot over again, and they tried to clean up the scuff marks, and they couldn't get it done. So they decided to just CGI it out later on, you know, because it was one wide shot where before the choking they went back to that angle again. But I love when you see some cool little thing, you know. I mean, first of all, it was really bloody and graphic, you know, strangling that guy to death. But the one thing that stood out to me most was the scuff marks and how that guy was struggling to stay alive.
It's interesting how you bring that up, because there's always something a little odd about a violent scene that'll make it more memorable if it were played out straight. And I think that the master of that, Mr. Fredrickson, would have to be Coppola. I mean, you talk about the violent scenes in The Godfather. There's just always a little something odd, a little odd element in each of those scenes that make it just burn in your brain.
Yeah, the eyeglasses.
Yeah, the eyeglasses in 3. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Although some people are going, what the hell is that all about? But the light bulb in the hallway in 2, where De Niro like clinks it with his finger. The guy does. The guy does right before he gets killed. You know?
That's right. But Mr. Fredrickson, you've worked in the business so long and then on so many legendary projects. Has the role of the producer changed since you've started?
Well, the role of the producer, there's basically kind of two producers. There's the ones that get the movies made, and then they're the ones that make the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's sometimes it's one and the same, but most of the time the deal maker producers that get the pictures put together and packaged and mounted and made are too busy getting their next project going that they don't have time to stay on a project all the way through from beginning to end, because they got to get something else going just to cover their overhead.
That's right.
So it's becoming more sort of separate. That wasn't the case when I first started out, but it's more so now. That's the only difference. But producers still do what producers do.
Yeah, but it seems like such a, you know, with the advent of DVD that has taken over so much and so many more markets, does it make for more opportunities to get a film made and financed, or is it a lot more competitive now than it used to be?
It's always been difficult, and it's still very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But while I have you on, I can't let you go without asking about some of these classic productions that you've worked on. I mean, we mentioned them, the Godfather trilogy and Apocalypse. And I read something interesting from you. You know, Apocalypse, it's been written that it's one of the most troubled productions in history. And yet I read where you said that you had a great deal of fun on that set.
Because they were all high.
A lot of people had fun on the set. Yeah, we had good days. We really did. But, you know, it just wore us down. It went on forever. I had 2 birthdays in the Philippines.
Ugh, wow.
I came back 3 separate times. Once when we had the typhoon, once when we switched from Harvey Keitel to Martin Sheen, and once when Marty had his heart attack.
Right.
We had sort of hiatuses in those 3 times on the movie. And but after a while, it was such a terrible conditions there that it seemed like it was never going to end, and it wore me down. But no, there was fun moments. Yeah.
Listen, it's fun being on location, and you know, it's fun making your film. I did a film with Matthew Broderick, Funky Monkey, and Matthew wrote a book about his experience shooting Full Metal Jacket, which sounded exciting and grueling.
That's,
you know,
a great book.
It's another movie that just went on forever, and I was amazed at some of those stories that he told, you know.
Yeah, amazing. It's amazing. But did you get a sense working on some of these films with Coppola that you were a part of cinema history in a way? I mean, did it feel like that at the time you were making these Godfather films or Apocalypse?
No. At the time, no. I remember when we were making Apocalypse, Francis kept saying, this picture is going to do $100 million, and it's going to be the first picture that charges $5 for a ticket.
Wow.
And I wish you could go back to that.
Yeah. And he was right on both of those. But, no, at the time, no. You're just sort of caught up in the day-to-day activities, and you don't really think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Guys, you know, you walk into Gray's office and you see all of this, these pictures and memorabilia, and it's like nothing to him, and you're just walking around in awe. There's a photo of Gray and, was it John Milius and Spielberg?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God, what project did you guys, what was this? And he goes, oh, no, we just went to Disneyland one day.
Well, I worked with him, though, on a movie called 1941.
Oh, right. You were an actor in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's
we were
right.
Friends. We were buddies. We went to Disneyland together.
But it's got to be gratifying for you to have been part of these films. I mean, you definitely have cemented your place in the history of the medium that you're so passionate about. That has to be gratifying.
I think that most people have forgotten them. I teach some film classes here in Oklahoma, and we started a film program here that's pretty successful. As a matter of fact, a lot of our students have been working on some of our films, and they were pretty good, weren't they, Harry?
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, and so I mentioned one time something came up about The Godfather, and one of the girls, one of the first days of class, said, oh yeah, Godfather, I just love George Burns.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh,
you know,
that's what it is to them. It doesn't mean anything.
The sad thing is, like, all these amazing movies that Gray has worked on and all the people that he's worked with, is none of them will take his phone call right now.
let me tell you, we're relatively young, Jerry and I, and your work and your contribution means the world to us. And,
yeah, it does.
We definitely will never forget. So just to give you a sense of that. Tell me, Souls Midnight, when we can expect the DVD release?
Well, the DVD comes out this coming Tuesday, February 12th, and
okay.
It's available everywhere, Netflix, Blockbuster, and as we said, the film stars international star Amanda Sante, Elizabeth Bennett, Rob Floyd, Miguel Perez, a real hottie named Lucila Sola, and Joe Napoli.
Right.
And these are all actors from L.A. that you've seen in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really cool gothic vampire story, and
it is a lot of fun, and it's very effective. I see so many movies come my way, so when one works, it's a real treat.
Hope you'll check out Fingerprints too, because Fingerprints comes out March 25th, and Fingerprints it will get an even bigger DVD release. It stars Kristen Cavallari from Laguna Beach.
Yes.
Josh Henderson from Desperate Housewives. He was the good-looking hunk who played Nicholas Sheridan's bad boy nephew. Andrew Lawrence, one of the young Lawrence brothers, Joey Lawrence's little brother.
Right.
And Leah Pipes, great actress who's on the CW's Life as Wild. And then it also has veteran actors Lou Diamond Phillips, Sally Kirkland, and Jeffrey Lewis. And it won Best Picture at the New York Horror Film Festival in 2006. And
oh, wow.
Came real close to getting a theatrical release. We were kind of bummed about it, but it's going to get a nice wide DVD release.
Well, here's what we're going to do. We plan on another segment to devote exclusively to Fingerprints.
Oh,
great.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Talking to your representative, and maybe we can bring you on with the screenwriting.
It would be great to have Jason and Brian on. Yeah, it would be great to have them on.
They're great. They're fun.
Hopefully, they have another project we're trying to get made right now called The Cow. That their script just won Best Screenplay at the New York Horror Film Festival, and hopefully we'll be in production on that.
Wow.
But what was I going to say? You can also check out clips from Souls Midnight on the Souls Midnight MySpace page. You know, there's like a trailer from it and some stills.
Okay, we will put you right at the top of our page.
Yeah.
And is there what's the website name? Do you have a website?
We don't have a website. It's just a MySpace. But they can also go on.
Harry's
Brothers
website.
Brothers Cleveland or Harry Basil MySpace or
okay.
Brothers Cleveland website. You know, www.brotherscleveland.com, and check out clips from our some of our films and find out what else we're doing and what's coming up. But hey, you guys, this was really fun talking to you. I've been listening to some of your archive shows, and it's just great to hear.
Can you say the F word on this?
Yeah,
it's XM Radio.
You can say whatever you want. You can just let loose on this format.
Say whatever you want.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Say cocksucker, Greg. Go ahead. I dare you. Come on.
All right.
But
don't,
we appreciate
don't go
you guys.
Harry.
We appreciate you guys coming on so much.
Thanks.
And Harry, we want you back on next month to talk to us about fingerprints in more depth.
Great.
And Mr. Fredrickson, you've done so much to enrich our lives with the work that you produce.
Wow,
thank you so much.
Guys, one last plug.
Yes.
Cold's Midnight is also screening at the Texas Frightmare. It's a big horror convention in Dallas, February 21st through the 24th.
Okay.
And they're screening, and Gray's going to be there. I'm going to be there. Our writers, Brian and Jason,
are
going to be there. And they're going to screen both of our films, Fingerprints and Cold's Midnight, there if anybody wants to
Wonderful.
See screen in front of them.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Harry Basil and Gray Fredrickson. The movie is Soul's Midnight. It comes out on DVD this Tuesday, starring Amanda Asante. And it's a really cool movie. It works.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. Sounds good.
It really does. It's a good film, and what a great time with them.
No,
I mean,
it was.
Just to hear an Amanda Asante impression was enough for me.
That was pretty funny. I like that. That was good.
And Mr. and Gray, you know, there's some people I just can't call by their first names. You know, like when we had De Palma on, I couldn't say Brian.
Yo, Brian, what's up?
You know, I have to give them the respect that they deserve. So
right.
Mr. Fredrickson, what a talent and what a roster of undeniably great films.
Yeah, and it's amazing the people that work with Al Pacino, Rodney Dangerfield. I mean,
yeah, and you know my heart on for Al Pacino, and
yeah.
I didn't even get to ask about Pacino.
I know, and I, you know, Eric had a thing, you know, asking what it was like working with Al, and like I said, you know, we know that Jamie's going to ask that question, but you know, you just don't have enough time.
Yeah, but man, what a talent! Nothing moves me more than people that are passionate about something,
mm-hmm.
and they make a difference.
And it sounds
like a difference in that.
The
yeah.
screenwriting brothers they work with, this team, is a very entertaining, endless well of creativity they got there, the Cleveland
yeah,
brothers. So
they, it's all about relationships, too, because if you hear how Harry started and with Rodney Dangerfield and then got hooked up with Coppola, and that began a relationship with
mm-hmm.
his producers, and that began the relationship with the screenwriters, and one thing leads to another. Relationships are so important in the industry.
That's right. Absolutely.
For opening new doors, and that's also very moving to me. The camaraderie between creative people, it's very very special, and that's what our show is about. It's
right.
about talented, passionate people, passionate filmmakers, and we try to bring them to you every week. And it's not over yet because Wednesday night we have, like I said before, Anastas Mikos, cinematographer for Scorsese, Shine a Light,
Marco Beltrami, right?
That's right. Composer 310 to Yuma, up for an Oscar this year. And Bo Goldman. Now, let me tell you about Bo Goldman. When I fell in love with Bo Goldman, his work, is when I've always been aware of him, always been aware that he has to be an enormous talent because he's written these classic movies, Scent of a Woman, Melvin and Howard,
mm-hmm.
One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, on and on and on, City Hall. You know, he's done some script doctoring for some major movies as well, I'm sure. It's when I saw the making of Cuckoo's Nest,
right.
The special edition documentary. He's interviewed pretty extensively about it. And towards the end, and actually he's the closing interview on the documentary, and he kind of sums up what the themes of the movie, what the movie means to him, what the themes are for him that he wanted to explore. And he really starts to break down in tears. And that's somebody whose work I want to follow.
Oh.
Somebody who just feels it from the gut, so passionate about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. And now, he's written and some other good stuff, too. Shoot the Moon with Albert Finney.
Shoot the Moon.
I like that a lot. And Swing Shift, which I know Swing Shift and The Flamingo Kid, he's uncredited, but those are both, I love those movies, great 80s films.
Shoot the Moon is amazing. And I remember, let me tell you how I first got into Shoot the Moon, is I read Pauline Kael, Pauline Kael wrote a review of Shoot the Moon that was over the moon. And for her to brag about so bombastically about a movie, you know that it has to be something special. So,
right.
So I tracked it down. I tracked it down on Netflix and finally got it and watched it. It's an amazing movie. It's an amazing movie where
great
you...
great in that. Finney's just great.
For better or worse, I mean, you so empathize with those, both of those characters.
Mm-hmm, you do.
Even at their most self-destructive.
And, yeah, very self-destructive.
Yeah, I remember what was it that Pauline Kael said? Pauline Kael said, what was the movie that Parker had directed before
Let's take a quick look here.
Because she had said there wasn't a single honest note in his previous movie, and there's not a single note that I found faults in Shoot.
Oh, wow. Okay, Alan Parker we're talking about. Do you know what the previous film is?
What?
Fame.
That's probably it.
Or wait a minute, or... Now, because Shoot the Moon is the same year, actually, as Pink Floyd the Wall. It could be Pink Floyd the Wall, maybe, she's talking about.
Maybe. Talk about a visual artist, Alan Parker.
Yeah.
What he's done with the musical. I mean,
mm-hmm.
His last time out was Evita, right?
The last musical was Evita, and then after that he did Angela's Ashes, which is all right, and The Life of David Gale, which I don't remember that much about. But
I kind of like The Life of David Gale. I like the turn it took. I know a lot of people...
I think I like what it was trying to say, like the themes and everything. I wasn't crazy about it, but I did appreciate the themes and some of the issues it brought up. I was fond of. I can't say I love the film, but I was definitely impressed with parts of it though.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I know that a lot of people cried cheat with the ending of it.
Well, it's not cheat. No, not that. No, it's an interesting film. I can't say I didn't mind the turns it took.
So I'm responding to people in the chat room.
Yeah, I know. Don't kick yourself. Don't you? That's got to hurt, man. Speaking of kicking yourself in the balls, we had a great day on...
Wasn't that great when Gray Fredrickson was... You can really curse on the show?
Yeah, I know. Speaking of Fight Club was on earlier, I had the choice of watching Fight Club and Three Kings on at the same time, so I kept going back and forth with those earlier today.
Yeah, those are good movies.
Yeah.
Three Kings, yeah, that's a good movie. Eric, what do you have to say for yourself, man?
Man, I just wanted to call and bust your balls a little bit about you could spit out.
He's already kicked himself in the balls.
you couldn't spit out and ask about Al. I don't understand that, man.
Well, you know when it changed? You know when it changed, man? It changed when he he didn't diss his own work, but he kind of said that, you know, people don't really realize what I've done. I mean, it's not going to outlive me, and that just breaks my heart. I wanted him. I was about to ask the Pacino question, and then he said that, and it just changed directions for me. And I was like, no, man. I mean, I'm talking to you. You've changed my life. These movies that you've been a part of, you know. So
I could tell you were leading up to him. I could tell those questions were getting to that point when you started asking about, you know, did he stay on the set for the show, you know, for the entire production there, or did he stay away? I kind of felt like I was going to that point.
Right.
He just never pulled the trigger. And,
you know, Pacino's always my money shot. So
I know it is.
When we had De Palma on, Pacino was the last question I asked for De Palma.
Yeah, that was. When you had Philip Baker Hall on.
I know, Philip Baker Hall. I was so predictable in my love of Pacino. This is really just therapy for me, this entire show.
But I actually want to go back to something he said that's sad, but it is true that there are people, you know, and it's not just younger people. There are people who don't know a lot of the great classic films he's done. They don't register when you mention some of those classic titles. They've never seen them. They don't know
we weren't that old, man. I mean, we weren't even, like, really cognizant of these movies when they first came out.
No, we weren't.
I was a newborn when The Godfather came out.
I was 2 years old when the first Godfather. I would have no interest. I didn't even have an interest, really, until my early teens, really, to understand the themes of that film.
There's a thought now that I remember reviewing the movie Seven, like, posting a review of the movie Seven a couple of, like, last year. And I got a response that was like, God, this movie's so old.
That blows my mind when people say that.
I am not kidding you.
No, that disturbs me. Once we're calling movies from even the early 90s old,
that always blows my mind.
But there's no sense of history, man. I mean, and there's no feeling among the youth of the relevance and importance of older films.
Yeah, well, let me bring up something that about last year. It's when 300 came out, which is a fun film, but the furthest I noticed people could go back is Gladiator.
Right.
No one goes back to, like, the, they didn't even go back to Braveheart, to be quite honest with you, but no one goes back to, like, Ben-Hur or Spartacus or Demetrius and the Gladiators. I know that's very old, but those are the films that influenced 300, though.
But it's like you said, Jerry, today's youth, they don't, you say Ben-Hur, they got no idea what you're talking about.
They think, who the hell is Ben-Hur?
Exactly. They don't know. I mean, talking a little bit about, just going back real quick to Al Pacino and the Godfather movies, and, I mean, obviously I had seen the first Godfather and saw a little bit of the second, but I didn't really get an affinity for those movies until Jamie turned me on to them. And, I'm 32 years old. You know, and then, I mean, even a movie like Scarface. I mean, I had seen bits and pieces of Scarface, but the first time I ever sat down and actually watched the entire movie was with Jamie. And he's the one who turned me on to all that stuff. And now it's like, I was missing all this. I was missing all this stuff for all that time because I didn't know about it. I wasn't exposed to it growing up.
I knew you, and I knew that you would respond to it. You would respond to great work like that.
Right.
But I think if we have any mission on the show, Jerry, I mean, that's probably it. I mean,
Not to condescend, it's not to preach, but it's to enlighten people that the films do go back beyond, you know, past the 90s.
Right, right.
We're not preaching, we're not condescending, but we're just trying to enlighten and maybe say, you know, if you like this, you might want to just look further back.
And we're not lying. These movies will absolutely do something for you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just astonishing to me, because I don't. And part of it's my age, I guess. But seven was 13 years ago. Coming on 13 years ago.
But 13 years ago. But that's not. I don't think of that as old. I don't think.
But listen to this. I saw on the news today. I saw exactly the 1 year anniversary of Anna Nicole Smith's death, and I'm thinking. It's been a full year?
Yeah.
That's exactly what I thought.
I don't feel that way at all. I mean, you know, it's hard to believe it's been a year, but, yeah, wow.
Time is merciless, man.
Yeah.
You got that right.
Yeah.
All right, brother. I just want to call and bust your balls a little bit.
All right.
Okay. Good to hear from you, my friend. Good to hear.
All right, brother.
I just said time is merciless. I expected you to start singing a ballad on your way out.
Well, <that's,
laughs> give me something.
Jimmy, you know me, and you know the one thing I don't do is sing.
Oh,
not
on the air. Come on.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
All right, you too.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Once I ask Eric G to sing Streisand, I mean, he's never calling again.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. But, wow, what a great show and some great conversations tonight.
Yes, definitely.
So I appreciate you being on with us. Our last guest did not call in. She was a reschedule from Wednesday. So she did not call in. So
okay.
We'll get to the bottom of that. Maybe have her on sometime next month. But we're out.
All right.
Great show.
All right. Great show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thank you very much.
And, Jerry, I'm about to call you because I forgot to tell you something, okay?
Okay,
just
cool.
To let you know.
All right, cool. Thanks.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.